I just thought, man, I'm the craziest person on the planet. The exact, like, I'm a Nepali, I think in Nepali, so the exact words made were sansarko sabhanda baula manche ho ma.
For many years, thousands of Nepalis have been moving overseas with the hopes of a better education, job, and lifestyle. Some find success in conventional fields, while some carve their own paths. Who is to say one is better than the other? Success is a journey, not a destination. So, come on this journey with me, where we connect with our Nepali communities living overseas and explore their conventional and unconventional paths. My name is Sankalpa Gurung, and this is Hamro Yatra.
And welcome to the 15th episode of Hamro Yatra. I'm excited to present to you our guest for today, journalist, mountaineer, motivational speaker, comedian, social activist, Shaili Busnett. Shaili started her career as a journalist fresh out of college and very soon found a way to satiate her hunger for adventure. Shaili, along with 9 other women, successfully climbed Mount Everest, the world's highest mountain, just at the age of 25. This was just the beginning. Shaili then co-founded Seven Summits Women, who have then gone to successfully climb the highest summits in the remaining 6 continents of the world. She is passionate about quality education, women's empowerment, and doesn't leave any stones unturned to give back to the community. Shaili is also the first Nepali to perform at Gotham Comedy Club. I could go on and on about her accomplishments, and the list would still fall short of covering this powerhouse of a woman. In this episode, we explore what drives Shaili to take life by the horns, deep dive into the idea of success and the importance of play. Her journey is absolutely astounding, and I hope it encourages you to find your own Everest and conquer it. As always, if you enjoy these conversations, please share with your friends and family. Remember to follow our Instagram page at hamro.yatra for updates. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a 5-star review if you're feeling generous. Welcome to Hamro Yatra, Shaili. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Amta. I'm excited to be here.
Now, I usually like to start the interview by some icebreaker questions. First one being, if you could choose any superpower, what would that be?
Well, I never thought about that.
I mean, you've already done pretty super powerful things. I'm pretty interested to find out which superpower you'd pick.
Honestly, the only real superpower I really think that there is, if anything, is enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not like the commercial movie kind of super power, but that's the one I'd pick.
Each to their own. Now, the second one is, if you could have one cuisine for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
As a Nepali, I think it's pretty obvious, dal bhat tarkari. I grew up on it. Now, because I have to travel and everything, I don't need it like twice a day, every single day. But if I had to pick one thing for the rest of my life, there's no doubt about it.
Yes. I think 90% of my guests, wherever they are in the world, no matter what age they left Nepal in, mm-hmm. they would still choose either dal bhat or momos.
Oh, yeah.
Those two are like the top two cuisine dishes.
Yeah. Like, I got introduced to international cuisine and whatever, even the other healthier food in Nepal. Like, now I eat a lot of fapar ko roti and chakla, all of those stuff. And I love it. So I don't eat dal bhat every single meal anymore. It's probably once a week kind of a thing. But I grew up on it for the first, like, at least 2 decades of my life. So if I have to go back to one thing forever, it has to be what I started with.
Exactly. I think when we were growing up, mom used to make like dhiro and different things. And at that time, I was like, oh, like, I don't want this. I want pizzas and burgers. But now that you actually understand the importance of how nutritious dhiro is, like barley, millet, and all that things, I'm like, wow, we were already so good like beforehand.
It's so true. And I am discovering this now, you know, in my adult life, and when my close friends, when they visit my place, unannounced, like when I've not prepared anything special, it's all dhino, gundruk, like I said, roti, kodo, and chaklite, a lot of that, and all of these stuff. And so my friends always tell me that when they visit me, it's like visiting their village.
That's wonderful. And the last question is, if you could go back into a historical moment in Nepal, just to see what that was like, just to experience it for yourself, what would you choose?
Again, I might be in a very specific phase of my life right now, but I would think, wouldn't it be wonderful to be around Lord Buddha? When
I love it.
Yeah, like just imagine... you know, just and any time, like the time when he came back home to meet his wife, his parents, his son, and he initiated them into his practice. Like, imagine being there for that. Wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now, before we delve into where you are now in terms of your life, career, I wanted to go back into time and talk about what your childhood was like. How were you as a child?
As a child, I was very happy. I was super excited. I grew up in a middle-class family in Kathmandu, so we never had... any problem of, you know, not having enough food or not being able to go to school. But at the same time, it was not a privileged life either. You know, we knew that money came hard and parents worked really, you know, hard for it. And when I was really young, you know, before maybe the teen years hit, I was particularly very vibrant, very full of life. One of my favorite memories of my childhood is whenever I used to look into the mirror, I love telling this, especially to young people, I would just get so excited looking at my own reflection, because I would be like, I'm a human, you know, tigers are stronger and elephants are bigger than humans, but they don't go to the moon, you know, they don't make discoveries and inventions or write poetries and, you know, make music. All of these things humans have been doing. So I just used to get so excited. I used to be like, oh my God, I am a human. So whatever I want to be, there's no limit to it. So I would look into the mirror and I would just wonder, what am I going to do with this human life? So that's like my key memory from my childhood.
Oh my God, that is so amazing.
And sometimes we forget, you know, when we grow up, and that's why I say this was before my teens. When the teens started, nothing too traumatic or, you know, tragic, but still the conditionings, I think, of the time and society we're born into, the gender roles, you know, expectations, all sorts of things. I would say there was a phase where I felt a little down for maybe a couple years, and thankfully I bounced back.
And when you were growing up, were you more into academics, sports, or the arts?
I myself did not ever categorize myself, and that's one thing I still can't do. I'm still hopping from one thing to another, so I'm just a happy human. I can fit in anywhere. But back then, I was this bundle of energy, and I just needed a channel to pour it, and it could have been anything. And that's today when I do my work, when I especially meet with young people, you know, this is something I always like to keep in my mind, because when you meet young people, they're just pure bundles of energy. They don't know if they're poor or rich, if they have maybe some kind of, you know, disabilities physically or otherwise. It actually doesn't matter, you know, the energy that you are could be poured into becoming what you really want to be. And I was just that. The school I went to was good with academics, so I was fine. I was not like excellent student, but at the same mm-hmm. time, I was not a bad student either. So I enjoyed especially maths. I enjoyed science. I loved Nepali classes. All of that. I still remember some of the lessons from Nepali classes and English and math. Math and science becomes part of your life anyways. You really truly can't function without it. So. Studies was good, but growing up, we didn't have much sports, and particularly for girls, there was not much sports in my school.
Of course.
And the environment itself was, even the teachers kind of discouraged girls from playing sports.
Exactly. I think the only sporty thing you could do was dance, and even the dance would have to be classical Kathak. There wasn't any like modern dancing.
It's very funny. I don't know where to land. Well, those years, not just me, all my friends too, we're doing really well in life now. We didn't even dance really. Like there was not much extracurricular activities for those specific years when we were growing up. So all we played was chungi. Rubber band. Do you remember rubber band? Like today when you say rubber band, you think of a hair tie or something, right? But when we said rubber band at that time, it literally meant tying a string of like rubber bands. And
when it broke, then you would just like hit the people on their sides as well.
Yeah, it would snap on your like knee or something. Yep. So we played that, and then we played tsungi, of course, gatta. We played a lot of it.
Oh, yes.
So those were the sports.
Exactly.
I played, and those were, of course, the preteen years. Once we got into the teens, at that time, you know, SLC was this big thing. So you kind of just study. That's your time to just study. That was one. And another is also puberty has hit, and you're kind of not, you know, sure about your own body. And, you know, there are people commenting, saying things. And on top of that, the teachers themselves weren't creating a very positive environment, saying that, you know, sports is an important part of growing up. So
100%.
You just kind of get into a shell. So that's what happened, I think, with not just me, all my friends, my best friends that we went, like we grew up together with. But we're all big mouth. So, I mean, we didn't play, but we were big mouth. We never shut up.
I can relate to this 100%. All the friends that I grew up with back in Kathmandu is pretty much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, when you reach a certain age, then most of the sports are really not there. And you don't really know the benefits of exercise either.
Yeah.
Like you learn it in social studies, like, oh, regular exercise, moderate, balanced diet, but you don't really put that into practice.
That's so true. Yeah. And also the other factor in retrospect probably is that I'm just a lazy person. So if somebody doesn't make me do something, if I don't find a reason to do something, then I can just chill like forever. Okay, I can be like a completely useless blob that can just lie there and is just like flying in her own like seventh sky, you know. So I think that was also my childhood. There are some kind of people, and of course this I learned later in life, there are some kind of people who are born wise and are fighters, and you know, if there's not something, they will, like my friends in my team that I, you know, later joined and climbed mountains with, they're such incredible heroes. If you listen to their stories, you know, facing child marriage at 14 and being the first in your entire family ever to go to school, complete high school, you know, they fought real challenges, and at that age they had the wisdom to say that, you know, I'm born for bigger things than getting married at 14. You know, I didn't have that. I was not that. I was just, I guess, happy in my bubble, and I didn't even realize the impact of what I was missing. I knew I was missing sports. I was very clear about it. That much brain I had. But I was like, you know, when I grow up, I'll play. That was my big childhood dream. You know, I never dreamt of being like a doctor or actor or whatever. My big dream was, when I grow up, I want to play.
Mm.
By nature, I am a person, I need goals in life. So if you give me a goal, If you tell me, Shaili, produce 100 podcasts for me, then I'll do it. Then I'll move mountains to do it. But I can't have maybe a regular kind of a job where I'm supposed to go to, like my parents did, you know, go to an office for maybe 9 to 5 or 10 to 5 for 30 years of your life. That's like, I would terribly suck at it. But if you give me a goal, then I'll move. That much, thankfully, that's the saving grace in my life.
So how did you get into reporting?
So I finished my undergrad in IT and management. The course was called BBIS, Bachelor's in Business Information Studies. Because at the time, I mean, you know, IT was the big thing. And of course, you needed management skills. But by the time I finished it, I realized that I did not want to pursue it for the rest of my life. I was clear. I did not want to be in front of a computer for the rest of my life. I wanted to travel. And I thought journalists travel a lot. This is, I'm being very honest in this podcast. And I did that. I applied for Himal Media. I sent a letter addressed to the publisher, Kanak Mani Dixit. And I was called, what I learned later, for a job interview. And because I had no background in journalism whatsoever, I asked myself, would I give myself a job just by looking at my empty CV, which literally just said that, you know, she's graduating from this course. So I thought I wouldn't give a job to myself. And I asked myself, what would make my case? So I just sat down and wrote two articles, one in English. It was about the impact of globalization on local culture, and then which is something that has never been published. And then the second was in Nepali, which talked about the state of Nepali language in today's urban youth, which was really affected by English and Hindi. So we're basically forgetting Nepali, kind of a thing. And that one, that piqued their interest. And I was called for that. And it actually got published. And I got the biggest, like, you know, surprise shock of my life. I was like, what? They published it?
I love that you took initiative, first of all, but then you're also writing things that are relevant. And not just writing things just for the sake of it.
No, I at the time I was not trying to fool anyone. I was trying to get a real job, and for a real job, you have to have some merit, right? So I was really trying to prove myself, and I was very fortunate that I mean, Himal Media is a fantastic newsroom. So when you write to the publisher, publisher sends you to the editor, and then the editor gives you the freedom to pick issues and report on it. It's literally getting wings, you know. So I got that very, very supportive and nurturing kind of environment in that newsroom, which I'm still very thankful for. And again, this is, you know, without anybody recommending me. There was no, as they say in Nepal, source force, you know. I was an anonymous person who just sent this CV without even a picture. They didn't know who I was. They just looked at the article and, you know, thought that it might be interesting for them. So I did my part. And, you know, I like to say that I believe in luck, but I believe that you create your own luck. And I think that's what happened here. I did my part and I also got lucky.
And in around 2007, while working for the same publication, you then became aware of an opportunity to join the first inclusive Women's Sagarmatha expedition. Now, Shaili, the first thing I wanted to ask you on this was, what was going through your mind that led you to take that leap?
I wanted to experience the ability of human body, that childhood dream I had. With me, it was not just a wishful thinking. I was serious about it. So I had told myself all the years I was growing up that when I grow up, when I make my own money, when I get to that age where I don't need to ask other people for permission, like, you know, asking my parents or teachers, then I had very clearly told myself that I was gonna just play. Like, and I didn't know what kind of play. I might have joined some sports team or gone rafting, kayaking or trekking. I had no idea. Anything would have done. So I was serious about it. And while working at Himal as a columnist, as a correspondent, that's when I learned about this Everest expedition. And when I learned about it, I couldn't sleep the entire night. I went crazy. I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is exactly what I've been waiting for. I can't just let it pass. I have to give it a shot. So then I talked to the organizers, and they were open about having me in the team. I was already looking for that, opportunity. And like I said, I was young, I was naive, I was innocent. I didn't know what would have like satiated my dream of being physically active. It could have been anything, but fortunately for me, there was this opportunity and I just applied for it.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you weren't particularly sporty when you're growing up. Now, for anyone not into sports or physical exercise, climbing Mount Everest is quite a big inspiration. What was the training process for you like?
Okay, first of all, I must say that ignorance is bliss. So, and that's the power of the youth, you know.
You feel you're invincible.
Yeah, and like they say, it's quite cliched, you're like a clay. You could be molded into any shape, form, right? And thankfully, mountaineering is a sport where you can start in your 20s. Like, for example, it is so funny. I was talking to a group of female soccer team from a college in the United States, and they were asking me when did I start, and I was telling them I was 24 when I started training, when I started with the mountaineering training, and they were all laughing because they're like, oh my God, that's the age when most elite athletes retire. Because a lot of sports, you have to start much younger, right? But mountaineering is not that. Mountaineering, Junko Tabei, the first female ever to climb Mount Everest and also the seven summits, she was still climbing in her 70s before she passed away. So fortunately for me, mountaineering was great. I, of course, had no clue if I was even 1% worthy or fit of even having this dream. I have no athletic background or experience. I look very, very, non-climber. I'm petite, I'm short, I've always been underweight. My image of a climber does not fit my own, picture. So I asked the organizing team again, and they said that we'd be joining this mountaineering training which is organized by Nepal Mountaineering Association, and the course is called Basic Mountaineering Course, and that confuses people. People think that, oh, basic must mean like pretty, simple, but it's not. You start from basic stuff, which is knowing how much water to drink, knowing the kind of health crisis you might get into high altitude from, high altitude pulmonary edema, cerebral edema, those kind of things, kind of clouds, all of those things, all the way to ice climbing. Literally, we were with ropes and, everything would be dropped into crevasses. We'd have to rescue ourselves from crevasses. We'd have to rescue our friends. We have to learn self-rescue techniques. So this is pretty advanced training. And we go higher than 5,000 meters. We're actually on ice wall and a glacier and all of that. So, and the training is 45 days, including the theory classes, navigation classes, all of that. So I went for this training, and this is where I learned about my strengths and weaknesses. It was obviously way, way, way tougher than I could have ever imagined. But at the same time, let's just say it did not break me. I just knew that I could work on my weaknesses and I could enhance my strengths after the training, and I could continue the journey with this incredible team that I just met.
Now, in May 2008, at the age of 25, you successfully climbed Mount Everest. How did it feel to be on top of the world?
So here's some of the thoughts that was going on in my head. One of the first thoughts I had was when I saw the summit with my eyes, I literally looked down at my feet, my boots, my crampons, the spikes kind of, you know, gripping on the snow and the ice. And I had the biggest smile inside my oxygen mask. And I thought, I'm the craziest person on the planet. One day I told myself I'm going to climb Everest. And today, this moment, I'm literally standing here.
Wow.
I just thought, man, I'm the craziest person on the planet. The exact, like, I'm a Nepali. I think in Nepali. So the exact words my head was, that was my exact thoughts. And then I looked around. Of course, the best part, you know, about being on the summit is the view. And when you look around, it feels like you're on a different planet. The ginormous mountains, you know, when you're going to the base camp, even you see all these Himalayan giants, and now everything is below you. These big mountains are below you. The clouds, horizon, everything is below you. And when I saw that, literally, there was a point when I looked and I thought, you know, in Nepal, I was born in a Hindu family. I also practice Buddhist meditation. In Nepal, the two are so mixed, you can't kind of sometimes distinguish one from the other. And in both culture, we regard mountains as where gods reside and mountains as gods themselves.
Right? Like that's Shivaji's home.
And when I was standing on top of Everest and when I could see the whole world below me, in that pristine bliss, I really felt, oh my God, they're right. I don't know what exists, but if there's anything called God or some kind of the absolute, you know, energy power, this is where they would dwell. There would be nowhere else. It is just, that was a moment when I was one with nature. There was no, you know, me and Everest. We were just one.
Wow.
So that was, that was what was going on.
Now, I can imagine that even with all the training, there would have been events that you were unprepared for. What was the most unexpected incident for you?
There were many, because we had 45 days of Everest expedition. And in fact, the normal, like the general time is 60 days that you're supposed to have. One of the things I've learned from mountaineering is that when you're in a high risk zone, like climbing a mountain, 45 days literally is a lifetime. So you go through a roller coaster of emotions, experiences, incidents, you know, a lot of it, even self-discovery. So there's a lot I could share with you. One of the quick ones I can tell you is, when we went from base camp to the first camp, base camp is 5,300 meters and the first camp is 6,000 meters. So we went up and we spent two nights there, and there were some friends who spent one night there and they came back to the base camp, and there were some who spent two nights. So I spent two nights and then I came back to the base camp. And when I came back to the base camp, of course, like you're tired, you're exhausted, you know, and we are very closely knit, Tim. So we were like each other's pillar of support. So I knew my friends would be there for me, you know, whenever I needed them. But that moment when I scaled down from the first camp and when I got to the base camp and we're entering like my team, like our specific camp, the girls who had returned the previous day, I don't know how many of them were there, 3, 4, maybe 5, they ran around like little ants, you know how ants do teamwork. And someone brought a chair, someone brought a glass of juice, and asked me to sit. Someone literally opened my shoes for me, my boots for me. I had tears in my eyes. I was completely capable. You know, I was not in an accident. I was not... there was nothing wrong with me. I was perfectly fit and healthy. And yet my team, who was more rested, they had one night more rest, you know, were there to welcome me in that way. They're opening my boots for me. And I had tears in my eyes at that moment. I just felt so lucky to be in such a team where it was not about, you know, competition. We grew up hearing that women are women's worst enemies and, you know, the game of jealousy and pulling down each other, all of that. Oh my God, I want to tell the whole world, whoever, you know, believes in even like a 0.5% of it, that's a major BS. You know, that moment is a proof when I was not even in a crisis and here are my teammates, just doing everything. And we had so many of those moments, you know, where we're just there for each other. And it was not a competition. It was not one having to beat the other. We just bonded like fingers in a fist, you know, and just went for it like we're all fighting, which was true. We're fighting for the one same thing. And there are moments when we were quite selfless about it. So that is a special, that moment was a special mental bookmark in my head.
Mm-hmm. So it was a very collective effort.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, after the climb, you, along with most of the women from the team, started the Seven Summits Women. What were you looking to achieve with this initiative?
When we went for Everest, it was a pretty big deal because there were only seven Nepali women before us who had climbed Everest and, of course, started from Pasang Lamu Sherpa, our hero, you know.
That blows my mind. Like, Everest is in Nepal and we only had seven women climb it. Like, that's just...
Exactly. Yes, and we went for it. And when we started, there was... definitely a lot of, you know, suspicion, doubts, and discouragement that our team faced. In mountaineering, it's very important to know that even if one person makes it to the top, you know, you're successful as a team. Or in fact, the better way to say it is that one person on top is success for the entire team. Everybody coming back alive and intact is a bigger goal. So we knew that very, very well, of course, which means that we didn't know. We never knew if we would make it on top or not. We knew that, you know, we'd all be given shots, we'll be trying, but again, it's not a competition. So when this Everest expedition came to an end, out of the 10 women, people had maybe expected, and the same people who were criticizing us then became friends later, and they were telling us that, oh, like we thought maybe one or two of you would make it. We were ready to rescue girls because you girls look like recipe for disaster. We literally heard these things, you know. So we didn't know ourselves. We didn't know how many of us were going to make it. But when we finished this expedition, out of the 10 of us, all 10 of us reached the summit of Everest. And it was a super success. And the best part, we came back alive and intact. There was no accident, no rescue required. You know, we were all, we came back great. And when we reached Kathmandu, it had become major news. We were the headlines for I don't know how many days. So it was pretty big. Everybody from the leaders of the country, from the prime minister to, you know, business people, journalists, everybody were talking about it. So to be very honest with you, that success was so exhilarating, blinding, deafening. I think we felt unstoppable. So there was no reason for us to stop. The only right thing for us was to keep continuing to go ahead. And we didn't know what to do next. So in that process, we brainstormed on a few things and we decided that we want to climb mountains out of Nepal. At the time, we thought that, you know, being Nepali, we'll of course climb other mountains in Nepal, you know, that will happen. But let's just take our big, proud Nepali flag, the sun and the moon, and let's just wave it across the world. That's how this dream was born.
And in 2014, the team actually managed to climb the top summits in the seven continents. Now, Shaili, how did this accomplishment feel compared to your first climb?
Compared to the first climb, the Seven Summits climb was very humbling because Everest was one mountain. And I'm not saying this in any way to kind of trivialize the expedition. But the truth of the matter is, Everest was one mountain in our home country. We faced a lot of challenges, struggle. You know, I could write an entire book on it. But, you know, at the same time, within 1 year of having the dream of climbing Everest, we're already on top. When we returned, we're 100% success. Mm. But when we decided to climb the seven summits, it was now six more mountains in a different continent with a big team. And in a lot of these places, we don't speak local language. We know nobody. We used to say that even the bacteria there doesn't know us. You know, it took us a really, really long time. And our real struggle started after Everest. Seven summits became way more difficult and continued for a much longer time period. We had the dream of climbing seven summits in January 1st, 2009, and it was only in mm-hmm. December 2014 we completed the dream. You know, so that was a good number of years mm-hmm. there. So by the time we finished, we had learned some incredible lessons. We had experienced a lot of highs and a lot of lows. Like we would get an audience in the White House. We got to meet the Secretary of State, John Kerry, at that time from Obama administration, you know, and at the time we didn't wow. even know, but like it's literally in the US, when you go to these government organizations, there's picture of Obama, there's picture of Joe Biden, and there's picture of John Kerry, like that he's the third most powerful person on this yep. Country. And he was meeting our team and telling us that he was jealous of us and he was proud of us, you know. So it was obviously that's a big high. And probably even a bigger high is when we started the mission, we received the flag from our own president, Ram Baran Yadav at the time, our president, to go on this journey. So these are the highs you can't compare. It's priceless, you know, money can't buy it. Mm-hmm. So we had these highs. We were on top of these mountains. And then we went to schools from, you know, Karnali region in Nepal to Tarai Madhes in Nepal to high schools in Australia to schools of Maasai kids in Tanzania, Africa, you know, and sharing mm-hmm. the journey of these young women from Nepal having this big dream and now, you know, traveling around the world, sharing that. And that's, again, priceless, injecting that inspiration to young minds, you know, that is again priceless. So we had these amazing highs, but at the same time, we'd return home and at times we would walk because we wouldn't have enough money to pay for Safa Tempo, you know. Yeah. And there were times where people would literally accuse us and attack us unnecessarily. There were times when we had no clue how we're going to move even one step ahead because we did not have either funds or the backup or the time when team members were quitting. And we also have our own lives, right? One mountain is fine. Now here, everybody has put everything on hold, from education to employment to getting married to, you know, starting families. Everybody's mm-hmm. putting all of these things on hold. So Seven Summits was a very, very humbling journey. We really saw some real highs and hit some real lows. So by the time, it's a very long answer to your question, but by the time we finished, I think this time we had become more humble, more real, definitely way more mature, and we had learned that no matter how much challenge or struggle we had to face, it was an honor, it was always a privilege to be on this journey, because a lot of people in our country, or any other country for that matter, a lot of young women especially like us, you know, don't even have basic access to education or healthcare, or, you know, they have to face a lot of difficulties like child marriage. We now work with young women who are survivors of sex trafficking. So imagine, you know, so we, by the time we finished the seven summits, we had come, I think, more face to face with the realities of the world. We had learned about these things in our, you know, travels around the world and had started doing some work back home in Nepal also. So by the time we finished, we were more real.
talking about helping women, the Seven Summit Women have also founded a not-for-profit organization to help rebuild schools impacted by the earthquake in 2015 in the Sindhupalchok area, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is also a second project where you provide mountaineering training and mentoring to women who are survivors of sex trafficking. If our listeners want to help, how can we get involved?
I like to tell people that when you think of being patriotic, when you think of loving your country, we don't always have to go to the battlefield. You know, we're very proud of our ancestors who fought on the battlefield and, you know, retained the sovereignty of our country. We're very proud of the leaders who fought for democracy, and because they stayed in jails or, you know, went through physical torture, we have the freedom of speech and freedom of education and all of that. And I respect, you know, all of that. But what is loving your country for this generation? We don't have to fight for democracy. We don't have to fight to retain, you know, the sovereignty of our country like our, you know, past heroes did. This is how I think we got to love our country. Help, you know, our own brothers and sisters and children live a life where they can see a bright future for themselves. They have the skills, education, confidence to just stand up for themselves and have a career that will get them out of poverty or low self-esteem. This is how we make this nation now. This is how we build this nation. And I'm sure the next generation will have next test to pass. This is the test our generation has to take. And Maya and I are determined to keep scaling this program and help people, especially young women, so that they can have amazing careers and just be, you know, be leaders, be go-getters. So this is the program. I'm super passionate about it, as you can hear. So I can keep going on about it forever, but I know the podcast has a limited amount of time. So anybody out there listening who wants to support this, please go to our website, 7summitswomen.org.
And I'll put it in the show notes as well, all the details. Yep.
And you can find us on Insta, Facebook, and go to our website. You can make a donation. You can write to us. You can volunteer as a teacher, as a trainer. There are a lot of different ways. You can just come visit the village maybe for a few days, and that helps somebody get employment. So there are a number of ways you can help this.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for telling us all about the different initiatives you've taken and what they actually do. And I think nowadays it's so easy to get caught up in your own world and your own, like, those first world problems. Mm-hmm. And you stay out of touch with actually what you can do to help those in need. So I think this is a really good way for anybody listening out there and thinking, rethinking their lives and thinking how they can, you know, help out or make a small difference. I'll definitely put all the details in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you have also spoken to audiences all over the world. Now, I just wanted to ask you, is there one thing or like one topic that has resonated with all your audiences, irrespective of where they are from and their ages or their genders?
There's not only one. There are, in fact, many. So definitely talking about women empowerment is something that resonates very deep with everybody these days, whether you go to a really remote region of the world or a very developed, you know, part where you're surrounded by super empowered women. Because everybody is clear that it's important and it is a challenge for this generation, whether doesn't matter which country you're from. You know, this is a work in progress mm-hmm. that we all need to invest in, and it really resonates well with everybody. That is one. With particularly Nepali community, what I have seen resonates a lot is that, yes, we are, you know, the country of Everest and Buddha was born in Nepal, but what are we doing to make our country better? Mm-hmm. What is my role? You know, are we always going to just fall back on Everest and Buddha? do I not have my own, you know, ability and responsibility? So that's a question that resonates very well about let's do something ourselves. Let's, you know, let us put our country into the global map with our efforts. That's something that really connects with Nepali hearts really, really well. That's something I've felt across all these places. And there are a lot of other things that make people think. One of the things I like to share with people is I'm into meditation and spirituality. And one of the things I have felt in my own journey is that, you know, we are all told to strive for success, right? From the time we're little kids, we have to do well in exams. Once the education is over, get a job, maybe get married, have kids, get a promotion.
In a house, a car.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about success, success, success. But nobody tells you what to do when you fail, you know? And in life, success is not guaranteed, but failure is. It could be maybe a financial failure. It could be a heartbreak, you know. It could be a relationship crisis. It could be a natural disaster that we've faced so many of, you know. And so failure is guaranteed. There is no way that a human life will not have to face failure. But we're not taught how to face it, how to deal with it, you know. And if you think about it deeply, as humans, we not only suck at handling failure, we also suck at handling success. You're super successful, and what have you been taught to do? You just what?
Yeah, what then?
What then? You party, you drink, you what? You know? So it's so funny that as humans, we don't know how to handle success. We don't know how to handle failure. And this is a topic a lot of people relate to. And then we get into this conversation about how it's important to know the true definition of success, let's just say, and how to kind of keep yourself in a place, in a way of life where it's not about the success that has been defined by others for you. So this is a topic that really I'm finding more and more people interested on it in recent years.
I usually ask this towards the end, Shaili, but since we're on the topic already, what does success mean to you?
Success is where I am in life right now, the way I can look back and say what success is. It is when the journey you have outside in the outer world helps you evolve in the journey inside. It helps you in discovering who you really are. That's success for me. And the more I think about it, there is no other success than that.
That is so well put. And I can certainly tell, like, from all the experiences you've had, this must have evolved over the time. And you just see more peace with yourself.
Yes, there were times when I was competitive, I was jealous, and there were highs that I really celebrated. There are lows that almost broke me. Then there's also a phase when, you know, I'm building schools or working with the Survivor Sisters, and there's some sense of giving back. But even then, you realize that even giving back is not true success if, you know, it becomes maybe a show off, or even if you don't show off, it's somehow just boosting your own ego, you know. One of the rules I have for myself now after all these experiences is that, you know, let's just say I want to write a book. Okay, now I tell myself that if I wrote a book and nobody in the whole world would ever come to know about it, will I still write it? You know, if the answer is yes, then I'll do it. Then, and if the answer is no, then I won't do it. For example, let's say, you know, before climbing Everest, if I imagine I get to have the exact same experience, I'll be on the top, I'll make it back safe and sound and everything. But if not a single person in the world would ever find out about it, would I still do it? Absolutely, 100%. Now, if that's the answer, then I should do it. And that's what probably true success is, you know, because if I am still doing it for just myself, then I am engaging in a journey of self-discovery. I am in that phase in my life, or that place in my life, where the outer journey is probably dull and boring if it does not help me evolve as a person. And that part is not for others. It's not for show. It's not for sharing. It's just, am I getting closer to my truth?
Mm. So I had this idea of the podcast over a year ago. Mm-hmm. I just kept thinking, oh, it'd be so cool if there was a podcast like this featuring Nepali mm-hmm. people like living overseas and ideas of success and how they've done things in unconventional worlds. And I kept thinking about it, but I never thought I would make it. Mm-hmm. And every now and then when I kept thinking, oh, maybe I should make it, I'd always have this answer come back right away saying, but who's going to listen to you? Why would you do it? And so that whole conversation kept going on in my head for over a year. And then, mm-hmm. well, I was like, you know what? This is something I really want for myself. I'm in this own journey of self-exploration, and I need to reach out to these people to hear about their journey. So if somebody listens, then that's amazing, right? But if no one listens to it as well, then I would have done something for myself. And that's just as good enough for me as having many listeners. So I was like, you know what, I'll just do it, go for it. And I'm so happy I did, because this has really helped me.
Yeah, this is
just reaching out to people like yourself. It's so inspirational. I would like to climb a mountain.
Yeah, and I tell this always, like, if I can do it, there's no way you cannot do it, or any person on this planet cannot do it. Just know who you really are. Just because you've met somebody who's climbed Everest or been to the moon, you don't need to do it. Like, is that you? Is that success going to bring yourself, you know, closer to your own truth? Your Everest could be, you know, bringing the stories of all these people to people, you know, who want to listen to this. Or you could be making movies tomorrow, who knows, right? So find your own true calling and decide what your Everest is. And if it's the real, literal Everest, go climb it. If it's a metaphorical one, find your Everest. Do it. There's no way anyone shouldn't be able to do it.
And recently also, Shaili, you have made a name for yourself in the comedy field, being the first Nepali to perform at Gotham Comedy Club. How does success fit into that side of the world?
When I started comedy, it was a stress buster for me because I was doing some like kind of heavy duty stuff with climbing and all of that. And comedy just became a stress buster, a side hustle for me. And again, I did not do it for money or any of, I had no plans. I was just having fun. But over time, it kind of has become a side hustle of its own. And I was in the US for a few months. I started going to the open mics, and I didn't know I've never lived in the US, right? I was born in Nepal, raised in Nepal, went to school here. I've never studied out there. So I didn't know if my material would be funny or like they would even understand it. So I just started going to the open mics in Colorado, and I started getting really good response. There were senior comics who were like full-time professionals and headliners, on television shows and all, they were telling me that, you know, they liked the fresh eyes I had on US. Here's somebody who's come from Nepal and, you know, is looking at US from a very different perspective than what they're used to. So that really gave me a lot of confidence. And again, I guess the whole thing about ignorance is bliss. So I just kept... I guess taking one step after the other, just like we do on the mountains, and got to Gotham. In the beginning, when I started with comedy, it was a side, like a stress buster, like I said. So I would make any kind of jokes, you know, anything, any funny thought that came to my head, I was okay with it. I would put it on stage. But over the years, in comedy, they say that you have to find your voice. I'm still working on it, but now I'm very clear that with comedy, my goal is to bring the developing world narrative and female narrative to the global mainstream entertainment. I'm very clear about it. And that's what success would be for me. And that success in the world of comedy would also help me evolve as a person internally.
Yeah. And you were going to be doing a world tour this year to help with the surviving sisters.
Yes. So plan for 2020 was to do maybe make like 10 stops, mostly in the US cities, but also other places, and raise funds in all of these different countries, cities, and come back home with a bag full of money so that we can train the survivor sisters for the next couple of years without having to worry about, you know, where's the fund gonna come from. Mm-hmm. So that was the plan. Now instead, what I'm thinking of is doing an online show sometime maybe around late November or December. And then I guess the good part is people from anywhere in the world can join it. So I'll have to find that sweet time spot where it works for people in different parts of the world. Yeah. So the plan is still there. Instead of a physical world tour, I'll just be doing one comedy show right now, and it's going to be a fundraiser for the Survivor Sisters. Mm-hmm. And then that's the plan. And then hopefully when things get better, I'll do a real comedy tour.
Yeah.
Maybe next year or so.
Please let us know when you finalize details for the online show, because we would love to help you raise awareness and whatever we can from our side as well.
Thank you so much. And again, you can go to my website, 7summitswomen.org. Mm-hmm. And I also have a personal website, just my name, shailibasnet.com.
Perfect. Now, Shirley, just to wrap things up, mm-hmm. if there's any advice you can give to someone who's struggling to find their path or struggling to find their Everest, what would that be?
The only thing that's going on in my mind these days is all the limitations are in your mind. Don't stop because there's a mountain in front of you. Look at the mountain and find a path in that mountain. Mm-hmm. It's doable. That's what mountains are for, you know. Maybe the mountains are not there to block your way, but they are there to show you the way. In Nepali, I tell young people, "Dalbat khara koi pani thulo manche hundaina." You know, if you have a dream, you better have the audacity to pursue it. Mm-hmm. So push for it, go for it. There's no reason why anybody should stop. Of course, you have to do the right set of things. You need discipline, you need hard work, you need, you know, not just hard work, you need to be smart about it as well. You need to have the capacity on it. You need to invest in yourself, learn the skills. You know, you the biggest investment you have to make is on yourself. You know, if I want to climb Mount Everest, just because I'm a female, I'm short, I'm Nepali, I'm whatever, Everest is not going to get easy for me. But at the same time, Everest is also not going to get difficult for me.
Yeah.
You know, Everest does not care if you're a man or a woman. Everest does not care what you are, who you are. You had the goal, you better be good enough for Everest. Mm. And then Everest is all smiles, right? So for people who are trying to find inspiration to pursue their own dream, this might sound a bit harsh, but you're the only person on your way. If you think that your parents or the world is in crisis, those are all excuses, and you should be able to find a way if the dream is really yours. And I have the confidence to say this again. It's thanks to my friends like Maya, like Asha, Nimdoma, my teammates. We're 10 women on Everest. Each one of them is a hero. Each one of them had big struggle they had to face in their, you know, early teens or even younger, just to get basic rights of education, you know, of again, not having to get married at 14. Mm-hmm. And then later, when I started working with the Survivor Sisters, one of the Survivor Sisters that I worked with, she was 12 when she was trafficked to a brothel in India. One of the Survivor Sisters was 9 when she was, you know, trafficked. So if they have the fire in their belly to transform their life and they're doing it, what are you complaining about? We, the right to complain is a privilege.
100%.
So go for it. Don't stop. Just do it.
And I think most of the times people also forget that it takes a long time to get to where you are. It's not like an overnight success. Like you said, the Seven Summit took over 5 years. You going into Gotham, it wasn't like, oh, I want to do comedy. And the next day, like you applied and you got into Gotham Comedy Club. Like it was years of practice just doing things, right? And one thing that really caught me by surprise was I thought climbing Mount Everest, it would take maybe like a week or less than. Like it's a like that's because like you just don't know. And then when I was doing research on your story, I was like, was it 29 days?
No, it was so the standard time is 60 days and our team took 45 days.
Like, see, that just blows my mind, right? So I think a lot of times people forget that going to where you are, climbing your mountain, whether it's a literal mountain or not, takes time, and to just be patient with yourself as well. And I think your story is just like perfect to just say that, like, listen, you have to be disciplined. You have to do the work to get to where you want.
I couldn't have put it better myself. You're absolutely right. I am not even 5 foot tall. I tell people I'm 5 foot on a good day, if I put on a small heel. And Everest is more than 29,000 feet. There's no way it should be possible for a, you know, 5 foot girl to climb that 29,000 feet mountain. But it is with the tiniest step that you climb the biggest mountain in the world. The only condition is that you have to keep putting 1 foot in front of the other. There's no shortcut. There's no wings. You don't fly. You don't drive. You just keep putting that 1 foot in front of the other. And that's what applies for any other dream you have, your own Everest. You just have to keep working on it. And there'll come a time, if you don't give up, your dream will show up.
Oh, I love that. Now, Shaili, your accomplishments back in 2008 was already inspirational, but you have then gone to break more barriers and motivated women, I would say, all over the world to follow their dreams. I think you hear this quite often, but we are so immensely proud of you and your achievements, not just you, but your team. I've read about like your teammates, Maya's story as well, Asha's stories as well. And we are excited to see where your journey takes you. And honestly, from the bottom of my heart, it's been such a privilege to interview you today. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time sharing my journey with you. And I'm not done, so save the praises for later. There's so much more. We, as a team, as Nepalese, as just human civilization, gotta do so. We got big mountains in front of us, and it's a fun adventure. So I'll keep climbing. You keep climbing. You're on this incredible journey yourself. And on the very last bit. My shameless plug again, when the comedy show happens,
of course,
everybody listening and you, I'm gonna make sure you all join.
Of course, 100%. And as you said early on in the interview as well, it's a collective effort, right? So we're gonna be here supporting you in your journey, whatever comes next.
Thank you. You're very, very kind. And I had a great time. You're very good at doing this.
Oh, thank you.
There were a lot of things. And I mentioned some of them where, because, you know, since 2008, people have been interviewing me and, you know, the general arc, people know it. But there were some that I was just sharing for the first time today. So you're really good at it. So keep doing it.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, we do.
As always, if you enjoy these conversations as much as I do, please share with your friends and family. If you'd like to share your feedback, you can reach us on Instagram at hamro.yathra or email askhamroyathra@gmail.com. I love hearing from you, so keep them coming.